Well, brethren, throughout the history of the New Testament church, you know, from the time of Christ and the apostles up to our current day, I think one of the subjects that's oftentimes on the minds of church brethren is how much longer do we have until the end? You know, until we see the events of prophecy in the book of Revelation playing out and, you know, Christ returning and the resurrection happening. You know, we look forward to those events, and we're oftentimes curious, you know, how much longer do we have, and particularly what signs should we be looking for to know that that time is drawing near? Well, when we look into that subject, we typically tend to look to the Olivet Prophecy, you know, because we know that's, you know, the question that Christ was responding to when he gave that prophecy to his disciples. We oftentimes look at the book of Revelation as well, and particularly what the book of Revelation refers to as the four horsemen, because we have seen we can correlate the symbolism of the four horsemen with a number of Christ statements in the Olivet Prophecy. However, one of the things we oftentimes, you know, tend to skip over and not really pay close attention to is the fact that in the Olivet Prophecy, while Christ did give some definite signs that he said were absolutely signs of the end time was near, he also listed a number of things that he specifically said would be just events that would happen throughout human history that we shouldn't confuse with signs of the end. He said they definitely were not signs of the end. So what we're going to do today is to look at this subject, and again, particularly paying attention to what did Christ say was definitely a sign of the end, and what things did he talk about that he specifically warned us not to be confused about because they were not signs of the end. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's The Four Horsemen and the Signs of the End. Again, The Four Horsemen and the Signs of the End. Now, to start off with, let's turn over to the Mark's account of the Olivet Prophecy in Mark 13. Again, Mark chapter 13. And we'll start reading in verse 3. It says, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, and John, and Andrew asked him privately, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled?'" You know, they're directly asking him, what's the sign of the end? Now again, he gives quite a bit of information here as following up to that question, but let's particularly pay attention to what did he say was a sign of the end, and what did he specifically say was not a sign of the end? Now continuing on in verse 5, "And Jesus answered them and began to say, 'Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and will deceive many. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be troubled, for such things must happen, but the end is not yet.'" You know, now notice he's mentioning, you know, false religion, you're going to see conflicts, you know, wars and rumors of wars. But don't confuse that with the sign of the end, because that's just things that are going to happen throughout history. That doesn't mean it's the end time. And pick up in verse 8. "For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be earthquakes in various places, and there will be famines and troubles. These are the beginning of sorrows." Notice again, he listed a number of things that would happen that I think any logical person can say, yeah, that's happened a lot throughout history and even throughout our individual lifetimes, where there's been wars, there's been natural disasters, there's been famines. But Christ, you know, specifically says this is just the beginning of sorrows. In other words, this is not signs of the end, is what he's saying. In verse 9. "But watch out for yourselves, for they will deliver you up to councils, and you will be beaten in the synagogues." Now pay particular attention to that word synagogue. We're going to come back to that, because that's a big clue on the timing here. "And you will be brought before rulers and kings for my sake and for the testimony to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all the nations. But when they arrest you and deliver you up, do not worry beforehand or premeditate what you will speak. But whatever is given to you in that hour, speak that. For it is not for you to speak, but the Holy Spirit. Now brother will betray brother to death, and father his child, and children will rise up against parents and put them and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all men for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. I notice he listed a number of things here and even very specifically said they're not signs of the end. You know, we read there a couple of statements of that as we went through this. But then notice when he was referring to persecution here, he used the word synagogue. Now what we're going to see here is that's a reference that makes perfect sense to the early church, you know, particularly the first century around that time frame, because persecution in synagogues was definitely something that happened there. If we try to place that in even our current day or even forward in the future at the end time, it doesn't really make any sense to do it in that context. Because then just to show you a couple of examples, turn over to Acts chapter 22. So I'm sure most of you are familiar with the fact that the Apostle Paul, you know, before he was called, he was a Pharisee and he was actively persecuting the church. You know, he's later struck down on the road to Damascus, and then, you know, he has a change of life there where he stops being a Pharisee persecuting the church and becomes, you know, a faithful follower of Christ and then becomes an apostle. But there's a couple of times in the book of Acts where he refers to his previous behavior of how he was persecuting the church, and he specifically mentions doing it in synagogues. And notice this in Acts 22 and verse 17. And then it happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I was in a trance. And I saw him saying to me, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. So I said, Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprisoned and beat those who believe on you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by consenting to his death and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. And then he said to me, depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles. See, Christ sent him specifically to the Gentiles because Paul didn't have a good reputation amongst a lot of the Jews because they remembered, you know, his previous behavior. And they were kind of afraid of him, you know. But turn over to Acts 26, and we'll see another example of this. What I want you to see here is just, again, this is a very relevant reference to mention synagogues in the context of persecution in the first century church. That was very much something that was happening. This pick up in verse 9 here of chapter 26. Says, indeed, I myself thought I must do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. This I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests, and they were put to death, and I cast my vote against them. And I punished them often in every synagogue, and compelled them to blaspheme, and being exceedingly enraged against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities. I notice, you know, Paul is, you know, specifically saying he was actively persecuting them in synagogues. Because, you know, a synagogue is specifically a, you know, a Jewish concept of their place of worship. But think of that in, you know, even in our current day or just, you know, projecting forward into, you know, the end time. Now, if you've heard my recent sermons, you know, my view of the end time beast is that's going to be an Islamic power that rises up out of the Middle East. Now, you know, the more popular theory is the end time beast is you know, a revival of the Roman Empire, and the false religion attached would be Catholicism. Now, you can go either route that you think is correct. It doesn't make any sense to talk about people being persecuted in synagogues in that context. It makes perfect sense if you're talking about the early church, you know, in the first century and beyond, in that time frame where synagogues were a common concept and persecution was taking place there. What I want you to see here is that, you know, when you look at the Olivet Prophecy, and this is true in Mark 13, in Luke 21, and in Matthew 24, the first section of what Christ addressed there are not signs of the end. He specifically says they are not. You know, what he's talking about is events that would happen throughout the history of the New Testament church, from the time he said that all the way up to the end, that would be troubling events that would take place. And he was warning them about this, but he specifically says, this is not the end. Don't be confused and deceived thinking this is the end. This is not the end. And we're going to see in the latter part of these chapters, he then later starts addressing very specific things that he directly says, you know, are exact signs of the end. But the reason I bring this out is I know if you've been in the Church of God for many years like I have, I grew up from birth in the Church of God. I have seen Church of God publications, you know, all of my life. We're always referring to the events, you know, Christ listed there of wars and rumors and wars and famines and natural disasters and such. And they'll write articles and say, well, it must be the end because, look, we got there's wars in numerous places. There's lots of natural disasters. There's areas of world where there's famine. And that's always interpreted like it's a sign of the end. Well, if we just take Christ's own direct statements, he said the exact opposite. He said, these things are going to happen. These are things you'll have to endure through. These are catastrophic things that'll take place throughout the history of the church. But don't be fooled. Don't be deceived. Don't confuse that with the end, because it's not. And we're going to see later in this sermon, you know, later in the Olivet Prophecy, he does start speaking about specific events you should look for that are signs of the end. But we have to, again, understand those things that are he's just warning us about that will happen throughout history. Now, just to see that, you know, this is consistent throughout the Olivet Prophecy. As you know, there's multiple accounts in the Gospels of the Olivet Prophecy. So turn over to Luke 21, and we'll see Luke's account of this, and see it follows the exact same pattern that we just read in the book of Mark. This is Luke 21 in verse 7. And they ask him, saying, Teacher, but when will these things be, and what will there be when these things are about to take place? So again, they're asking him that question, what's the sign of the end? What should we look for? And again, let's just pay attention and to what he says is not a sign. And notice this follows the exact same pattern of what we just read in Mark 13. Now, picking up in verse 8, it says, Take heed that you not be deceived. For many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and the time has drawn near. Therefore, do not go after them. And notice one of the deceptions that would come is people saying that the time, it's the end. and it wouldn't be the end because they would be misinterpreting the signs. In verse 9, But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for those things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately. Notice he's directly telling us, he's listing things here that are not a sign of the end. These are just events that are going to happen all throughout history, and there's going to be lots of times when these things occur, but don't get confused and think that's a sign of the end, because it's not. In verse 10, And then he said to them, Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be great earthquakes in various places and famines and pestilences, and there will be fearful signs and great signs from heaven. But before all of these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to synagogues. Notice that word again. And prisons, and you will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom, which all of your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. And you will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will send some of you to your death. And you will be hated for my name's sake. But not a hair on your head will be lost. In your patience, possess your souls. Now notice this followed the exact same pattern of what we read in Mark 13. Now just to address another concept here. You know, I've noticed over the years, again, that, you know, what's typically, you know, interpreted in the Church of God is we will look at, you know, the sign, the things he just listed and think, well, we're seeing this a lot in the news. It must be the end. And then you point out to people, no, Christ said it. These were not signs of the end, that these were, you know, situations that would happen all throughout history. And people will say, well, of course, you know, these things have happened throughout history. It's just when they're happening more often. You know, when you see them a lot in the news, well, that means it's the end. Well, where did Christ say that? He didn't. He specifically said these are not signs of the end. But now if we keep reading through the rest of the chapter, we'll see what he did say were definite signs of the end. Because he gives us some very specific events, and we'll see here, some of them are even a literal countdown, you know, for when the resurrection is going to take place. But now pick up in verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. In other words, now we're talking about specific events to look for that are definite signs of the end. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all these things that are written must be fulfilled. In other words, this is a definite sign of the end, is what he's saying. Now continue in verse 23. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And there will be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars and all the earth distress nations with perplexity, the sea and waves roaring, men's hearts falling from fear and the expectation of those things that are coming on the earth, and the powers of the heaven will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in the cloud with power and great glory. Now when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. Notice he's directly saying, these are the signs you should look for, because this is definite signs of the end. Notice in the first section of the chapter, you know, we read through a lot of things that are commonly happened all throughout history, and he specifically said, these are not signs of the end. Unfortunately, what oftentimes happens, even in the Church of God, is we lump it all together and we assume all of these are signs of the end, because that was the original question that the apostles ask him. And we don't pay attention when he makes the distinction and talks about the events that are not signs of the end, and he's very clear about it. But now turn back over to Mark 13. I want you to see it again. This follows the exact same pattern of what we just read. Mark 13, and this time we'll pick up in verse 14. He's going to give us another very specific event to look for. He says it's absolutely a sign of the end. In fact, this one gives us an absolute countdown to the resurrection. This is in verse 14. But when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing where it ought not, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let him who is in the housetop not go down into the house, nor enter to take anything out of the house, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his garment. But woe to those who are pregnant, and to those who are nursing babies in those days, and pray that your flight may not be in winter. For in those days there will be tribulation, such as not been from the beginning of the creation, which God created until this time, nor ever shall be. And unless the Lord had shortened those days, no one would be saved, but for the elect's sake, whom he chose, he shortened those days. Notice again, just like in Luke 21, you know, he first addresses all the things that are just going to happen throughout history. They're going to be common events. And he says, don't be confused by those. They're not signs of the end. And then he gives us definite signs of the end. Because notice in verse 14, he talked about when you see the abomination of desolation, that's a definite sign of the end. And he says, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Well, to understand what he's referring to, we just turn over to Daniel chapter 12. And what we're going to see here is this gives us an absolute countdown to the resurrection. So we know for an absolute fact that's a sign of the end. And this is Daniel 12. Let's just start reading in verse 9. And then he says, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed to the time of the end. And many shall be purified and made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly. And none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. But you go your way until the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days." Now all we have to do is ask the question, when does Daniel arise to his inheritance? Well, that's at the resurrection of the first fruits, at the blowing of the seventh trumpet, you know, during the day of the Lord. Okay, well, if these, you know, count down to when Daniel receives his inheritance, it's counting down to the resurrection. So he's saying, when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, you see the abomination of desolation set up, you know, and that's, you know, stopping the sacrifices and basically setting up idol worship in the temple. He says, because when you see that happen, that's a countdown clock. And you know then that there's 1,290 days from there until the resurrection. That is definitely a sign of the end. Because what we can see here is, again, there's a pattern that plays out, you know, through all three accounts of the Olivet Prophecy. But oftentimes we don't make that distinction. I know you probably made this observation yourself. I know I've seen it all of my life, you know, particularly growing up in the days of Worldwide when we had the Plain Truth magazine. You know, whenever there would be, you know, a lot of natural disasters that were happening, you know, maybe a year where you had numerous natural disasters take place, or there was famine in the news in various parts of the world, and wars that were popping up, articles would pop up saying, well, it's got to be the end. It's got to be close because look at all these signs, you know. And they would ignore the fact that, no, these were the things that Christ specifically said were not signs of the end. And so we have to pay attention to that. And if we do, we won't be fooled by these things. We'll know specifically what to look for. Well, another thing that we typically correlate with the Olivet Prophecy, and I think rightly so, is the four horsemen that are described in the book of Revelation. But again, oftentimes we make the same mistake in interpreting those. Because we think about the book of Revelation, we think of it as a book just addressing the end times. And we miss the fact that, while it does have a strong focus on, you know, the end times and you know, the you know, day of the Lord period and Christ returning and the millennium being set up and describing all of those things in detail, it's not the only thing that the book of Revelation addresses. Because if you go through the first chapter there, again, I won't take the time to read that, you know, at this point, but, you know, John specifically says he was told to take this vision and write it to the seven churches. Now, these were seven churches that existed on a mail route, and, you know, literally at the time that John was receiving, you know, this vision, and he wrote the book of Revelation. But as we've taught for years, and, you know, the letters we have in Revelation 2 and 3, they're not just letters that were written to, you know, the literal, you know, churches on a mail route that all existed at the same time when John received the book of Revelation. You know, it's also addressing the predominant themes throughout history. In other words, it was kind of addressing what the Church of God, you know, throughout, you know, all of time, from the time of Christ and the apostles all the way up to the end, you know, what they would be facing, the challenges they would face, the strengths they would have, the problems they would need to overcome, you know, just kind of the predominant themes, you know, throughout church history. Well, if you take that into consideration, he wasn't, again, just addressing the very end time church. You know, John starts off addressing, you know, the church of Ephesus, you know, which is the first century church, and then he addresses every phase throughout history all the way down to Laodicea at the very end. And see, if we keep that in mind and realizing it doesn't just focus on the end time, then we can look at Revelation chapter 6, you know, which covers the four horsemen, and know how to correctly interpret that. because if you've ever studied this subject, probably know we typically correlate the symbolism, you know, that's described with the four horsemen in Revelation chapter 6 with Christ's comments in the Olivet Prophecy, which I think is an accurate way to interpret that. But again, if we're going to do that, let's pay attention to the correlations that we're making, you know, with those four horsemen is in the section that Christ specifically said, these are, you know, challenging, you know, troubling times that are going to happen throughout history, but they're not specific to the end time. They're not signs of the end time. So let's keep that in mind as we look at that. So now let's turn over to Revelation chapter 6. Again, Revelation chapter 6. We're going to go through these kind of one at a time to kind of unpack the symbolism that we'll find here with the four horsemen. So if you have a ribbon in your Bible, you probably want to put it in Revelation chapter 6 because we're going to turn back and forth to this chapter a number of times throughout the rest of the sermon. But let's start off with in Revelation 6 in verse 1. It said, "Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, 'Come and see.' And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer." Now, as we're going to see as we go through all four of these, you know, this one, you know, we have to do a little more, you know, you might say detective work of comparison here and a little more speculation, you know, to kind of connect this one together, because the other three just, you know, give us more direct statements to kind of nail down exactly what it's talking about. But if you notice here, we have a picture of, you know, this rider is on a white horse. He's wearing a crown and he has a bow and he's going out to conquer. Now, this is very similar in a number of ways to a description we'll find of Jesus Christ in Revelation 19, but it also has some meaningful differences as well. And if we compare these, we'll get kind of an idea of what this is getting at. So again, you'll probably want to put a ribbon here in Revelation 6 if you have one. But then turn over to Revelation 19. And we'll see a description here of Jesus Christ when he's returning to the earth during the day of the Lord period. But let's just notice the details of this description, because we're going to find there's a number of parallels here, that this is very similar to what we just read, but there's also meaningful differences too. And that's going to give us, you know, more clues here as to how to put this together. This is Revelation 19 in verse 11. "And then I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat on him was called Faithful and True. In righteousness he judges and makes war. And his eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. And he had a name written that no one knew except himself. And he was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name called the Word of God. And in the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. For out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, and with it he shall strike the nations. And he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. And he himself treads the winepress of the fierceness of the wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." Now, as we know, this is a description of Jesus Christ. You know, he's riding a white horse, but notice he has many crowns, and it doesn't say anything about a bow. You know, because the description we read, you know, previously of the white horse in Revelation 6, you know, he has a rider, there's a white horse, and he has a crown, but he has a bow. So again, it's similar to Christ, but it's also meaningfully different. And what we're going to see is this suggests it's kind of a counterfeit version of Christ is what it's getting at. Because notice it's specifically mentioned in Revelation 6 that rider had a bow, and it doesn't ever describe Christ as having a bow. But also think about this. Well, how does, if someone's using a bow and they're going out to conquer, what are they going to shoot from that bow? They're going to shoot arrows. You know, that's what typically goes with a bow, is it's a bow and arrow. But let's notice also another comparison in the Bible that gives us some insight on this. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 6. It's Ephesians chapter 6, We're going to start reading in verse 13. It says, "Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand. Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, and above all, taking the shield of faith, with which you are able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one." So this will give us some insight into that bow and what that bow is firing. Because notice it's referring to fiery darts, and it's the wicked one. Well, the wicked one is an obvious reference to Satan. But it says he basically uses fiery darts. That's how he attacks people. You know, obviously, it's a symbolic picture of his temptations and how he tries to trip people up. But let's look at the Greek word that's translated here as fiery darts. Because what we're going to see here is it actually means arrows, like you would shoot from a bow. Now, the Greek word here is transliterated into English as belos. It's B-E-L-O-S, Strong's number 956. And the definition I'm going to read to you is from the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the New Testament by Spyros Sahaitis. And he defines it as, quote, a missile weapon, e.g. a dart arrow, in the New Testament used only figuratively for satanic temptations, Ephesians 6:16, where the expression "the fiery darts" seems an evident allusion to those arrows or javelins which are sometimes used in sieges in battles. Sometimes they are missiles fitted with combustibles and so forth. So you can see it's talking about what Satan uses to attack us is again symbolically pictured as like arrows. Well, you see, that fits with our picture of a rider using a bow and conquering, because he would obviously use arrows with that. Again, what this is leading us to is the picture of this, you know, this white horse and the rider on it going out to conquer with this bow kind of suggests to me it's kind of a counterfeit version of Christ, because the description is very similar but also different. But now turn over to Matthew 24. We'll see here a statement that Christ makes in this account of the Olivet Prophecy that gives a detail that we didn't see there in Mark 13 and Luke 21. This is Matthew 24 and verse 4. "And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many." See, he's not just referring to false religion, he's also referring to those who basically present a counterfeit version of him. Of saying they'll come preaching that Christ is the Messiah, that he is who he says he is, but they're going to deceive many. You know, they're presenting a counterfeit version of who he is and what his gospel and his message is. And see, this is something, again, not unique to the end time, because again, this is, you know, these types of heresies are addressed in the New Testament. You know, in my last sermon, I addressed the subject of Gnosticism. You know, that the Apostle John, in addition to, you know, recording his gospel account in the book of Revelation, he wrote several epistles that, you know, that we refer to today as 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. And one of the main themes he's addressing there is the heresy of Gnosticism. You know, and he kind of distinguishes what he calls the spirit of Antichrist, and he says it's denying that Christ came in the flesh. And as I explained in that sermon, you know, Gnostics would say, yes, that Christ was the Messiah, but they had a very perverted, twisted version of who Christ was and what his message was. You know, because they had this idea that, you know, he wasn't really a flesh and blood human being, you know, who had to go through the, you know, the temptations and the torment the Bible describes. No, he just kind of seemed like he was a physical human being. And they even twisted his message of obedience into, well, you know, the body is just evil, and you just connect with God through this, you know, ethereal knowledge that you have, and it's just knowing this knowledge gets you salvation, and you can continue to sin as much as you want to because the body is evil anyway. See, it was a very counterfeit version of who Christ is, and that was occurring in the first century, and that's occurred all throughout history ever since. Because see, what we'll see here is that, you know, the first horseman is again correlates with the false religion, you know, that Christ warned about in the Olivet prophecy. But again, notice he wasn't saying that's specific to the end time. Yes, there'll be religious deception at the end time, but he wasn't saying when you see religious deception and false religion, you know it's the end. He's saying, no, that's something you're going to deal with all throughout the history of the church. And don't think just because you see it that it's the end. Now turn back over to Revelation chapter 6, and we'll pick up with the red horse here. This is Revelation chapter 6, and this time we'll pick up in verse 3. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, come and see. And another horse, fiery red, went out. And it was granted to one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and there should be given to him a great sword. Now, oftentimes we look at this particular, you know, verses here, and we see that, you know, it mentions great sword, and we think, well, this is war. Well, I think that's definitely, you know, included in this. But let's notice there's a little more involved in this than just war. Because notice it mentioned it was to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill, and with a great sword. So what we're going to see, it's taking away peace, it's resulting in violence, and then also war. It's kind of in including all three. Now, just to share with you the Greek word here that is, you know, translated as peace here in this particular verse. It's transliterated into English as Irene. It's E-I-R-E-N-E. It's Strong's number 1515. And again, the definition I'm going to read to you comes from Zahaites, you know, the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the New Testament. It says, quote, peace, particularly in a civil sense, the opposite of war and dissension, among individuals, peace and harmony. So again, it's not just the opposite, you know, of war. It's talking about taking away peace and harmony among individuals. Now, if we look at Christ's statements in the Olivet Prophecy, what we're going to see is he mentions all of these concepts. You know, it's not just specifically war. He did mention war, but let's notice what else he mentioned. Turn back over to Matthew 24. This time we'll start in verse 6. Said, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must happen, but the end is not yet. Again, just notice that again. He's specifically saying you're going to see these, you know, wars, you're going to see violence. That doesn't automatically mean it's the end. In verse 7, for nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Again, that's what we think of as formal wars. But also jump down to verse 10. And many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. Now, if you have hatred between people, what does that do? It takes away peace. It takes away your harmony. You know, and people getting along with each other, and there being peace and tranquility in relationships. Well, see, that's what typically happens before you get to violence or all-out war. And what this is saying is this horse kind of encapsulates all of that, that all of these things are going to happen. But let's also notice again, when we correlate it with the Olivet Prophecy, it's on the list of things that Christ said, this is going to happen. It's going to be part of history, you know, from the time he gave this all the way to the end. But don't think that this is, you know, unique and specific to the end, because it's not. So now turn back over to Revelation 6, and we'll pick up with the black horse here. So Revelation 6, and this time we'll pick up in verse 5. And when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. Now it's obvious from this description this was obviously has something to do with the food supply. You know, because, you know, it's particularly mentioning, you know, wheat and barley here, which were staple crops, you know, and it has something to do with that. Now, notice it talked about him holding a scale. You know, a scale is something you weigh things on. The reason I mention that is the Bible specifically speaks about when grain is sold, you know, in terms of weight, in other words, it's being portioned out, that is, you know, seen as a sign of scarcity and famine. And to notice that, turn over to Ezekiel chapter 4. It's Ezekiel chapter 4. And we'll start reading in verse 16. It says, "Moreover, he said to me, 'Son of man, surely I will cut off the supply of bread in Jerusalem, and they shall eat bread by weight, and with anxiety, and shall drink water by measure, and with dread, that they may lack bread and water, and be dismayed with one another, and waste away because of their iniquity.'" In other words, it's referring to famine, when you have a shortage of food. But notice it's particularly correlating that when it says they're eating it by weight, you know, when you're having to weigh it out, it's being rationed, you know, that's a sign of scarcity of wheat. And again, this referred to wheat and to barley, which again were staple crops in Israel. And but just to flesh out the rest of the symbolism there, I'd just like to read to you a quote from a biblical commentary addressing these verses, you know, Revelation 6, verse 5 and 6. And this is called Andrew's Bible Commentary. And let me just quote to you how they explain the rest of this, because I think it adds some insight to the subject. It says, quote, "When Christ the Lamb opened the third seal, a black horse appeared. John saw the rider holding a scale for weighing food in his hand and heard an announcement from one of the four living creatures regarding the prices of wheat and barley. In ancient Israel, grain, oil, and wine were the basic necessities of life." Deuteronomy 11, verse 14, Joel 2, verse 19. And to make and eat bread by carefully weighing the grain indicated grain scarcity or famine. Leviticus 26, verse 26, Ezekiel 4, verse 16. In John's day, a denarius was a daily wage. Matthew 20, verse 2. In normal circumstances, a daily wage would have bought all the necessities for an entire family. However, a famine would have enormously inflated the market price. In the scene of the third seal, it would have taken a whole day's work to buy just enough food for only one person, since a quart of wheat was a daily ration for one person. So as you can see, what it's describing here, you know, the symbolism here is clearly indicating famine and a shortage of food. Well, if we turn back over to Mark 13, we'll see this was in the list of things that Christ mentioned was going to happen. But again, let's just notice it's in the list of things he said were going to be the events that would happen throughout history. And you know, he was warning people it would take place, but he specifically said, don't get confused with thinking this is a sign of the end, because it's not. Now, this is Mark 13 in verse 8. "For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be earthquakes in various places, and there will be famines," in other words, a shortage of food, "and troubles. These are the beginning of sorrows." Again, notice he follows up with, you know, don't think that this is the sign of the end, because yes, this is a sorrowful event. This is something that's going to happen throughout history, and it's going to be a painful, you know, difficult thing. But this is not something just because you see famine, you know, that it's going to be an absolute sign of the end, because it's not. Now, to finish the last horse here, go back over to Revelation chapter 6. And now we'll pick up with the pale horse in verse 7. "And when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, 'Come and see.' And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him. And the power was given to them over the fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. Now, as you can see here, it refers to the writer here as death. It says the grave, you know, Hades is following him. Then it gives us a number of means of which people are dying. Take note of the fact that it doesn't mention pestilence directly. The reason I mention that is all of my life growing up in the Church of God, I've heard the explanation put for this particular horse, and they'll get to these verses and say, this picture's pestilence, and as if that is just solely what this is about. Notice it never mentioned pestilence here directly. Now, as we're going to see here when we kind of unpack all the details of this, I think you could argue that pestilence is included in the overall picture of what it's talking about. But I just think it's interesting to take note of the fact it does not say pestilence here anywhere. You know, and oftentimes how you hear these verses explained is just specifically that it means pestilence, and it just doesn't actually say that. Now, to kind of unpack what it's getting at, again, it mentions the name of the rider of this horse is Death, and he's followed by the grave. You know, so obviously we're talking about death. But it says he's given power to kill. Now let me read to you the definition of the Greek word here for kill, because this gives us some insight. It's transliterated into English as apoktenio. It's apoktenio, a Strong's number 615. And again, the definitions I'm going to read here, all of these definitions are from Zahaites. He defines this as to slay, to kill outright, put to death, particularly to put to death in any manner. The point I want you to see from this is this is involuntary death. This is not, you know, this is not a situation, you know, where someone just, you know, they lived to 80, 90 years old, their body just wore out of old age, and they died naturally. You know, that's not what this is getting at. This is really referring to premature death. Now, if you look at what it listed here, you know, as I pointed out, it doesn't specifically mention pestilence at all. When it gets to how this horseman is going to kill, you know, cause premature death, the first thing it mentions is by the sword. Now, that's obviously a reference to violence or outright war as a result, you know, but again, no mention of pestilence. And then the next is with hunger. Now, hunger here kind of has the obvious connotations, because when you think of dying from hunger, you think, well, that's a result of famine. And that is correct, because the Greek word here that's, you know, that's translated hunger here is limos. It's L-I-M-O-S. Strong's number 3042. And again, this definition is from Zahaites. It's, quote, it refers to hunger, famine, want of food. It is spoken of single persons suffering hunger, of cities or countries experiencing famine, of scarcity of grain. So again, it has kind of the obvious implication of what you think of as famine. But now notice it says, it mentions, you know, death by beasts of the earth, and then it just says with death. Now, if you look up the Greek word there referred to as death, it has a very broad definition that can, you know, cover death by a number of sources and in a number of contexts. It's kind of more of a generic term. But let's just, you know, place this, you know, kind of in line with the context of everything else. What we're talking about here is this particular, you know, rider who's called Death and followed by the grave is given authority to basically kill a fourth of mankind through a variety of means. It's not just specifically pestilence. Now, I think we can include pestilence in the overall picture, you know, but it gave us violence and you know, the sword, you know, either, you know, individual violence or all-out war. It gave us through famine, being killed by wild beasts, and it just kind of gave us the broad category of death. Well, if you turn back over to Matthew 24, we can again correlate this with Christ's statements in the Olivet Prophecy. And we'll see here that, yes, pestilence is something that we can put on this overall list. But let's notice here in Matthew 24 and verse 7, for a nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Again, this is the sword. This is war. and there will be famines. Now, that was directly mentioned, you know, and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. So see, now we have diseases and natural disasters that are being included. And of course, we could obviously include that in, you know, kind of the generic term death there that we read in Revelation 6. But again, notice here, the totality of this together is then followed up with in verse 8. All these things are the beginning of sorrows. In other words, these are events that's going to happen all throughout history to the church and, you know, to the world in general. But don't interpret this as a definite sign of the end. In other words, just because you watch the news and you say, well, yeah, there's wars in various places and there's violence and there's shortages of food in various places and there's been a lot of natural disasters this year. You know, don't interpret that as, well, it's got to be the end because these things are happening. No, he said, don't be fooled. Don't be deceived by that. These are things that are going to happen. That doesn't automatically mean it's the end. But see, there's another insight that we can pull from Revelation 6 there with the pale horse. Because notice it said it was a fourth of mankind. What it's referring to here is that God put a limit on how many people would suffer, you know, premature death through these means throughout history. You know, which he was going to put a cap on it and limit it to one-fourth. But see, oftentimes we tend to interpret this and try to stuff it all into the end time. And that's the exact opposite of what Christ said. He said all of these things would happen, but that's not the end. But then notice that in the latter part of the Olivet prophecy, he gave us specific signs. He said, you know, you see armies surrounding Jerusalem. They're about to have a military takeover. You know, that's a sign of the end. When you see the sacrifices stopped and the abomination of desolation set up, that's an absolute countdown, you know, to when the resurrection is going to happen. Those are definite signs of the end that we can look for. But there's a more important lesson that we need to learn in all of this. As I started off in the introduction of this sermon, I mentioned that, you know, from the time that Christ gave the Olivet prophecy to the apostles all the way down to our time, one of the major focuses of church members, I know it's been true all of my life, has always been how much longer to the end. And we're always trying to figure out exactly when is the end. And we're always trying to watch world events to see if we can see the signs for that to come about. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying for a moment you should bury your head in the sand and not pay attention to what's going on in the world. But we need to make sure that we're having the right definition for when Christ said to watch, what he was referring to. He was talking about watching our spiritual condition. Because he repeatedly tells us, you know, he told the apostles, and you know, this was recorded for our edification today, that we're not going to be able to know in advance. You know, all of my life, I've always, you know, heard various people claiming, I've figured it out, you know, got this chart and this formula to figure it out, and here's the date Christ is going to return. And every time someone's tried to predict that, it's always failed. Because Christ said he himself didn't know when he was going to return. And he told us that was not for us to know. He told us there was more important things for us to focus on, and that's what we need to take out of this. Now turn over to Acts chapter 1. And we'll notice here, you know, Christ literally told the apostles, you know, essentially to put it in modern day terminology, when they ask about when the end was, he essentially told them it's on a need to know basis and you don't need to know. You know, and then he told them what was more important to focus on. Notice here in Acts chapter 1 in verse 4. Now just to give you the time setting for this, this is kind of at the end of the 40 days that Christ spends with the apostles, you know, after he's already been resurrected, you know, and he's back to being a God being. You know, so this is about, you know, 40 days, you know, past his resurrection and about 10 days prior to Pentecost, you know, in the Acts chapter 2 story where they receive the Holy Spirit. But notice the instructions he's giving them and the question they ask of what's on their mind, because they're on massively different pages about what they think is important. In verse 4, and being assembled together with them, he commanded them not to depart from Jerusalem, but to wait for the promise of the Father, which he said, you have heard from me. For truly John baptized with water, but you shall be baptized with the Holy Spirit not many days from now. Notice, Christ's focus is upon them receiving the Holy Spirit so they can change their minds and their hearts, and then they can be molded into the character of, you know, of God the Father and of Christ. That's what he's focused on. Now let's notice what their focus was on. Verse 6. Therefore, when they had come together, they asked him, saying, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? In other words, Christ, tell us when the end's going to come. How much longer is it going to be? That's what was on their mind. Now notice his answer. And he said to them, it is not for you to know the seasons which the Father has put in his own authority. In other words, need to know basis, guys, and you don't need to know. In verse 8, but you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be witnesses to me in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. See, Christ was focused upon them being converted and them spreading the gospel to help convert other people. Their focus was on how much longer till the end. And again, we can fall into that same trap as well. But see, that the important thing for us to know is if we keep our spiritual house in order and we stay close to God, it's not really going to matter exactly when the end's going to come, because that'll ensure we make it into the kingdom, regardless of whether the end comes in our lifetime or long after we're dead. Because if you notice, turn over to Matthew 24. Well, notice the latter part of the Olivet prophecy, Christ addresses this very thing. In fact, he even tells us that he doesn't even know the day or the hour of when he's going to come. It's on such a need-to-know basis that only the Father knows. This is Matthew 24 and verse 36. But of that day and hour no one knows, no, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. For as the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. Then two men will be in the field, and one will be taken, and the other left. And two will be grinding at the mill, and one will be taken, and the other left. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. Notice he didn't say, watch, so you'll know what hour it's coming. No, he said, watch, because you're not going to know what hour it's coming. He's not referring to watching world events or watching the news. He's referring to watching your spiritual condition so that, you know, you're ready and you'll make it into the kingdom regardless of when it happens. But just continue in verse 43. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not expect him. See, he flat out tells us we're not going to know. You know, he gives us signs at the very end, you know, the abomination of desolation set up, the sacrifices being stopped, the army surrounding Jerusalem. You know, he says, when you see that, it's happening. You know, the end is now. You know, it's all about to play out. But he said, you know, prior to all of this, we're not going to know. You know, we just need to keep our spiritual house in order and focus on our relationship with God. You know, and that way it won't matter when the end comes. Because just to share with you a personal thing I learned a number of years ago. You know, as a lot of you are probably aware, I grew up in the Church of God since birth. Well, my wife Linda did as well. We were both second generation Christians. Our, you know, parents were baptized, you know, before we were even born. You know, and we both grew up, you know, really thinking, oh, the end's going to come before we have a chance to get old. You know, it's just a few more years away. Well, that obviously hasn't happened yet. But, you know, growing up as church kids, our definition of the end was when you see the events of Revelation happening. As I'm sure a lot of you are aware, Linda died of cancer, you know, back in 2008. Well, what happened then is on June 26th, we sat in an oncologist's office and found out she had months to live. It actually turned out to be 10 weeks and 2 days. It radically changed my definition of the end. Because wouldn't you this kind of thing happens to you, and you watch a 39-year-old go from diagnosis to death in 10 weeks and 2 days, you totally change your definition of the end. Because, you know, growing up as a church kid all of my life, you're thinking, you know, how soon is this going to come? And where is the place of safety going to be? And are we going to, you know, be ready to have our stuff to go to the place of safety, and this type of focus? And then you realize, well, what if you don't even live to see those events happen? Then none of that matters. The only thing that matters is, did you have your spiritual house in order and have your relationship with God right, so that you make it into the resurrection and into the kingdom? That's all that matters once you put it into that context. And so that's a lesson that all of us need to learn. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that we all bury our heads in the sand and not pay attention to what's going on in the world around us, you know, and looking for signs that, you know, that the end might be coming. What I'm saying is, the much more important thing is making sure we have our spiritual life in order. Because Christ flat out tells us it's going to be a surprise. You know, we're going to be caught off guard when the end comes. But if we have our spiritual house in order, you know, it's not going to matter. Because as long as our relationship with God is right, He'll take care of us. And the most important thing will be taken care of. And that's whether or not we make it in the kingdom of God. Because that is the purpose of life. So, brethren, as we go forward from this Sabbath, and again, we look at this subject of wondering how long the end is going to be. You know, how far out is it? And I guess we all wonder that. I wonder it too. But as we look at that, let's make sure we pay attention to the things that Christ said were not signs of the end, and the things that Christ said were signs of the end. Because that clears up a lot of the confusion, and that way we won't get fooled and think the end is coming every time we see bad stuff on the news. We'll know to look for the right things. But let's also keep in mind, the most important thing for us is to watch. And when Christ said to watch, He was not referring to anything we're going to see on Fox News or online or anywhere, any news source that you're looking at. He was referring to making sure our spiritual house is in order. So as long as we take care of that, then it's not going to matter exactly when the end comes, because we'll make it into the kingdom of God regardless of when the end comes.